Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
I still love Johnny, but he's not with us today. I mean, he's on the planet, but he's he hasn't expired. His expiration date hasn't come up yet. No, Johnny's actually out of town. So, and I'm thrilled that our dear friend John Bugsy Lawler is with us. And you listeners may recall the great show Car Talk with Click and Clack. And at the end of the show, Bugsy was always given due notoriety as a actually, tell our listeners about, you know what I remember? Tell our listeners about the brothers, because I remember one Christmas party. You remember this, Bugs. One Christmas party at the Boston Globe when the New England Motor Press Association gathers with many of the brass from the automotive industry to celebrate the holidays. The two brothers that were Click and Clack on Car Talk were asked to lead the Christmas carols, and they showed up as usual in Hawaiian shirts, and instead said that they didn't know the words to many of them, and so they led us in a rousing rendition of most of the radio commercials like Alka-Seltzer and the Brill Cream. Do you remember that?
I do, because they're insane. So, I mean, I remember we were in an elevator at Car Talk Intergalactic World Headquarters, and we were coming down with Berman, the producer, and Tom, Ray, myself, and some other poor souls that were on the elevator with us, and Berman started singing, "I Feel Pretty." So when we got off the elevator, everybody's singing, "I Feel Pretty, Oh So Pretty." And the poor souls in the lobby, they're all scratching their heads. They were, what the heck did we walk into, you know? But it was like being inside the asylum. The inmates were running the asylum back in the day, you know. We were on a plane. We got stuck in an airport in a snowstorm somewhere. I forget where it was. We ended up sleeping on the floor for the most part. And for some reason, Tommy started singing Zippity Doo Dah, and by the time we hit Boston, the whole plane was singing Zippity Doo Dah, Zippity A. it was the crazy train.
He surely had a lot of life in him, but unfortunately, he's no longer with us, is he?
Tommy's gone 8 years now, but yeah, he had two doctorates. You know, his PhDs, as he used to say, pilot higher and deeper, you know. But he was the most naturally funny, and he had the quickest wit of anybody I ever met. And it was
as
just
I recall,
right off the – yeah.
His of course, brother he had a Ray was five. Like – how many years younger than
how many years
than
younger than who? Ramey?
Ramey's was how many years younger than Tommy?
10, I think.
And he used to bring him with him – class at MIT to babysit him.
He did. Yeah, he brought his. He used to take Saturday classes, and he used to bring Ramey with him.
After we lost Tommy, they started piecing together some of the past radio shows of Car Talk and airing it for a while. But I think it's completely off now. Is that right?
I think it's done. Yeah, Dougie's doing Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's out. He moved out to California. Ramey's still here. I talk to him a couple of times a week, you know. But, you know, it was a good run. I mean, for heaven's sake, it was probably almost 40 years. But from the first time they went on the air until, you know, now, it's over 40 years.
Well,
that's a long haul.
You know, we certainly miss them. It brightened up a whole lot of Saturday mornings, including myself. And I was very – I didn't know them well, not like you by any stretch, but I was – always happy. They always remembered me. They were just lovely guys. But the thing is, it's a good segue into what I want to open up with today, which is the good old days. And, you know, with Tommy and Ray, one of the things that in these stories you just told, Bugsy, is we don't laugh spontaneously anymore. We don't.
No.
We don't have. We have so many inhibitions. People are so pent up. Of course, it was very difficult to laugh through a mask during COVID. Yes, but theoretically, that's no longer with us. Needless to say, the fact is that times have changed, and so have people. And the same can be said, of course, for cars. So some time ago, we did a show with you, Bugs, about some of the wonderful things that were in cars that are, alas, no longer winning with us, such as smoker's windows, cigarette lighters. Talk about these things.
Well, everybody can live without cigarette lighters. I don't think there's many people that smoke anymore unless you're rolling the doobie. You know, I guess everybody does that. But what they did, they replaced cigarette lighters with USBs, which is a good thing. Smokers' windows should come back. The vent windows should come back because on a nice day, you want a little breeze. You can use those wing windows, as they used to call them, and get a nice breeze inside the car without turning on the AC and trying to find the right spot. You know, it was kind of nice to get some fresh air, you know, back then.
Why do you think away with them? Because
I'm
of
sorry?
The electric window?
Why did they change it? No, aerodynamics, I think it was 68, I think they did get away with them. I mean, once again, it was Uncle Sugar coming after us and saying, this is good for you. You know, 68, we got side marker lights, and we got, I forget, it was 67, 68, 67, I think we got, most of the cars got collapsible steering columns and things like that, and you know, but some of the stuff that comes along later on, they're just doing it just because. You know, like all the cars at the intersections now, they shut off, and then they come back on. And as you said, you're concerned, is the car going to start again, or am I going to sit here in traffic?
I hate that so much. I don't understand where there's any value in it except bringing your blood pressure up several dozens of points.
Well, somebody's idiot brother-in-law got paid to do a study. Probably the same guy that repaves the roads in Connecticut daily. You know, I think it's all part of the same crime family. You know, and they decided that the car turning on and off at an intersection was good to save a few ounces of gasoline. Well, people, you can override it for now. But once they hear you and I talk about it today, they're going to bypass that because, you know, you can't have any choice. There's no freedom of choice anymore, so you won't be able to override it, I'm sure, down the road, and you'll have to sit there and let it shut off. But for now, you can override it. You can bypass it.
But it's still yet one other thing that distracts you from running the car. And the other thing that we were talking about before we got on the air that really distracts me is this on windshield.
The
heads up display. Yeah. I hate that.
Yeah. I can understand to a certain extent, but for the most part, at least in the beginning, I don't know if they've changed it or not. But in the beginning, when they were posting those on the inside of your windshield, the cops could see the number two. So if you were going down the road and you were doing 20 over, all they had to do was be able to read a couple numbers backwards, and they could tell how fast you were going. And say, well, wait a minute now. You can't say you didn't know how fast you were going. You had heads up, but I could see your heads up display. You know, I don't know if that's still the case or not. I haven't really kept up with the technology. But, do you need that much information up there? Probably not. But they also put up the infrared and the heat guidance, so you wouldn't run into animals and so forth. I don't think there's enough room on the dashboard to see things like that. You may have to put that up on your windshield, you know. But there were a lot of things that hit and ran. A lot of things we still don't have. We still have night vision, optionally. I don't know if it's a subscription because a lot of options are going subscription now. Did you know that?
No.
You buy a car and you want to be able to start your car remotely. You're going to pay so much a month, you know, and those type of options. And, you know, I figured once you bought them, you owned them, but if you buy some brands and it started with the chips, some of the functions, they would install the chips, but a lot of the chips weren't ready for prime time. We still have a chip shortage, which is why we still have a shortage of a lot of cars. So when they started delivering with chips that didn't fulfill, like heated and cooled seats and things like that, and they said, once we get the chips, we'll bring the car back, we'll put the correct chip in it. Well, the light bulb went off on somebody, and they said, you know what, we can deliver these cars, and then we can charge a subscription service for it, which I'm not a big fan of, because it's like, it's like paying taxes. It never ends. And the same thing with, a cold day in New England or a hot day in Florida. If you want to start your car, should you be paying a monthly fee? I don't know. I wouldn't do it, but maybe other people would.
Do that anyway for Sirius Radio, but my gosh, I had no idea. And talk about this chip shortage. So we're still caught up in that, huh?
Yeah, that's going to be a long time down the road. We've,
is it too much?
Go try to buy a generic drug at the drugstore, CVS or Walgreens, whatever. A lot of times they're out of the filler materials for the generic drugs because we don't make them here. They're made over in China, and then we put the stuff. We're assemblers, whether it be medicines or automobiles or whatever. We put together the final product, and that way there we can say it's built in America. But for the most part, we're assemblers. We're not building a lot of stuff here. Very sad.
So it's true, though, that most of this stuff does come from China, and it makes no sense when you just toss that one into all the scathing political and,
It has nothing to do with politics. It has nothing to do with politics. Everything comes from China. People feel good about themselves about, buying an electric car. Well, Ford came out and said, I think they said $30,000 that they lose on each electric vehicle. I may be a little off on that, but that's still a big number. Even if it's off by a little, it's still a big number. But all these things that, the rare earth minerals can't be mined in the United States, so we got to get them where? In Africa. And you got big machines, diesel machines that are mining these minerals, and you move tons and tons of earth to get a little bit of rare earth minerals, and then you got women and children breaking the big rocks into little rocks, and then all the rare earth minerals go to China, whether it's be for wind turbines, whether it be for batteries. We're not making that stuff here. And all the chips are being made in Taiwan. So if in fact China ever goes into Taiwan, what happens then with all the chips? Are we going to be walking? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
We don't make a lot of things here.
And we mentioned that, one of the big components of microchips was mined out in Afghanistan, which kind of sheds a rather uneasy light on why we were there in the first place. But then again, Afghanistan has been at war since the beginning of time, and I think that every child born into Afghanistan must be genetically predisposed to that. I mean, it's all just beyond
Years ago, 60 Minutes came in and did a piece on Car Talk, and I spent some time driving Steve Croft. Steve Croft said to me, and he said to me, nobody can figure out the Middle East. He goes, I go over there, I'm a correspondent, I can't figure out the Middle East. So, as you say, the tribes have been feuding for thousands and thousands a year. When there's nobody else around, that you go fight with your cousin or your brother. So I can't figure out the Middle East. I don't think anybody else can.
Or will.
Maybe we had peace and we were getting oil out of there for a while. Things were looking pretty good. And I don't know where everything, I do know where everything came apart at the seams when we bailed out in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that was unbelievable. But tell me something.
Well,
of the car innovations that we now see are almost standard, such as all the safety measures, what do you feel has been just the biggest contribution, let's say, in the past 10 years?
Probably crumple zones. Probably controlled demolition of the car when you get into an accident. Because people used to say back in the day, I'm sorry?
Explain to our listeners what that means, Bugs.
Yeah, well, back in the day, you'd get into an accident in your big old Cadillac, and it was all chrome on the outside, all chrome on the inside, all hard surfaces, and you'd get into a fender bender, and, you know, you didn't have seatbelts, so, you know, you would hit the car in front of you, you know, then your head had hit the dashboard and your brains had hit the inside of your medulla oblongata, and and that's when people got serious injuries and died. Well, and then say, wow, you know, they got to know that the guy died, but there wasn't a scratch from the car. Well, of course not, because they hosed the car out and they sold it to the next guy, you know, because they didn't move. They were all rigid materials. Now, if you get into an accident, you walk out, you go, oh, my goodness, that car looks like a beer can. You know, it's all crumpled and ribbons. I saw a big luxury car. We were doing the introduction. It got T-boned by a gravel truck. And the woman got out of it and said, give me another car. But the car was literally ribbons where the, you know, the big truck had gone up the side of it and into the middle of it. So you're going to sacrifice the car pretty much every time you get into a major accident today. It's a total loss. They don't bother fixing them because there's no point to it. Everything is connected to everything else, and everything is engineered to take the controlled implosion, you know. But then you got airbags and you got seatbelts and you got, you know, lap bags and shoulder bags and Gucci bags, and, you know, everything goes off but you're able to get out of the car. You know, so that's probably, safety is probably the best feature, you know.
And not only that, the fact that there are so many precautions and, you know, of the imminent oncoming crash or accident or conflict or something. So that's all part of the safety measures. But I wanted to kind of take a little bit of a digression here and talk about the comfort that we're seeing in cars. Now, today, for example, I'm going to be talking about the Mitsubishi Outlander, which I loved, but I'm finding that more and more cars, I don't know how to explain it. It's like a mutt. You get a couple of dogs together whose lineage is uncertain in the first place, and they spawn other puppies that, you know, their lineage is not quite clear, you know, what their breeds were. And I'm seeing this in some of the design elements on the interiors of cars, particularly the seats. And this Outlander, which I'll talk about after we say goodbye to you, Bugs, I loved it dearly. But it's got those kind of, what do they call them, where the sides of the seats come up a little bit, like...
Bolster,
like
side bolsters?
Yeah. It's like a sports car, but it's not as pronounced as a sports car seat. And
right.
So those side bolsters, you know, it's in this particular model car, it's there. It's a lot gentler. In the sports coupes, I need one of those poles, vaulting poles, to get in and out of the seats because those bolsters really cut into me. I hate them. But I'm not very happy with these, what I'm seeing in this and other seats, where they're starting to kind of make the driver, make the passenger feel that there's a little sporty element to the, you know, interior design of the vehicle, the exterior design of the vehicle. So although they're not trying to mimic sports coupes, they're trying to give it that George Jetson feel. And I'm seeing this more and more in passenger front and driver's seats. And the reason I don't like it is because it makes me very unhappy and rather depressed, because it reminds me that I've got to lose weight. I mean, your thighs cut into these things and cut off the circulation sometimes, and then you get out of the car and say, yeah, I'm not going to have lunch, and forget dinner, and then you do, and then you eat too much, and then you get depressed, and then you get in the car all over again. So I don't know why we see this, and I guess, you know, you can look at any four-door sedan, for example, and there are cars that you can't tell who made them, or they all have so much in common, like through competition with other makers. And so I guess my question to you, Bugsy, is very simply, why? Why can't the designers be, you know, pleased with, you know, why do they have to do this? Why can't they just be, you know, happy with what we've got? I mean, there's an old New England saying, which is true, If they piss in the pot, it tastes better. They think it tastes better. And I understand that. Car designers want to do something that's a little more cutting edge or reflects the personality of the car company. But why? I mean, you can't improve certain things. And sometimes when you do, you find out that it's not an improvement at all. It's quite the opposite.
Are you talking about the overall shape of the outside or the inside, the seats, the side bolsters or the outside?
Both in a way, but in the interior particularly, the side bolsters, the seats that have very short seats, I don't know why, and then it cuts into your thigh, your calf.
The side bolsters, they're supposed to keep you, you know, from what they learned in racing and so forth, they keep you positioned. You know, you're not sliding all over the base of the seat and, you know, with the belts and the shoulder belts and all the other belts, you know, you're not going to go anywhere anyway, but maybe you get a little more feeling of security from the side bolsters. With that being said, that's better for a younger person. When you get, you know, middle-aged spread, it can be interesting getting in and out of one of those cars depending on how high the side bolsters really are, you know.
And I think about these women, that are having plastic surgeries to enhance their butts. I mean, fortunately, I didn't have to pay to have that happen. It happened to me naturally. But these women that actually do, I mean, where are they going to put all of that? And what if it pops? I mean,
you know,
there's many considerations here.
You know, I'm getting a visual here that I'm not happy with. You know,
I don't even want to go into adjustable seatbelts either because that's a whole other.
No, but let's talk about something fun. Let's talk about aerodynamics.
Yes, let's.
You know, they for a while they follow patterns. It's, you know, monkey see, monkey do. Back in the 70s, they went to the box design. You know, the roof was a box, the front was a box, the back was a box. Things started getting more aerodynamic as things went on. The jelly bean shape, and we got up for fuel mileage, and it was sporty and so forth. And now you notice that people are getting different takes on the. You know, they adapt. Things are they're all still going for the aerodynamic shapes, but they're starting to identify their own details. Like you look at a Kia, you know it's a Kia. You look at a Hyundai, you know it's a Hyundai. You look at a Lincoln, one of the sport utilities from Lincoln. You look at the interior, first of all, it's Class A interiors. They're just beautiful interiors. Genesis, beautiful interiors. You look at a Genesis, and there's a little bit of this luxury car, a little bit of that luxury car, but you know it's a Genesis now because you see enough of them on the road, and they're just beautiful cars. So it takes them a while to adapt sometimes. Some of them are behind the curve because they're not changing models every year like they used to. You know, they used to retool every year back in the day, although some of it was perception. I'll explain that in a minute. But they don't do the retooling like they used to do. They do a design, and then they'll change the chrome, which is plastic, or they'll change the moldings or some body lines or so forth. So they're not going for big, big money, you know, every year or every 2 years like they used to. Now, that being said, if you go back to 1958, I saw a picture of this one time. It says, you really think that the new cars look alike? Take a look at 1958, and it had a bunch of 58s, you know, parked side by side. And if you took the chrome off the front of them, you couldn't tell which was which. The Cadillac, the Oldsmobile, the Buick, Pontiac, a lot, not just them, but all of them.
Yeah.
There was a lot of similarities back, and they were modified by the jewelry that you hung on the car, on the front of the back.
Yeah.
So the more things change, the less they change.
It's changed for sure. And one of the things that I've noticed is that we've gone from soft sculpted bodies on especially two-door cars and four-door sedans where they were kind of soft and almost organic. Now what we're seeing with some of these new models are very, very highly sculpted, almost geometric.
The way they make the panels now, you couldn't put that kind of detail in 20 years ago. If you did try to get those shapes and those sharp lines, you would have wrinkled the sheet metal. You wouldn't be able to do it. But just the ways they're making the stuff now, I mean, they use water pressure now to stamp a lot of these parts. and the detail on them is amazing. They're beautiful. You could, and look at the paint jobs today. You take any new car, they're all two-stage paint jobs, base coat, clear coat. In the old days, it was single, and you had to polish it and sand it, this and that. To get a finish like you do, even on a low-end vehicle today, would have cost you $10,000 10 or 15 years ago. You know, and the higher-end cars would have cost you $20,000.
Yeah, and then they've got these pearlized finishes.
Yeah.
That you get as an extra.
Yeah.
And they're absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
But then what happens is that, you know, it begs the question, and I know that something like a pearlized finish is an extra, but, you know, it begs the question, car companies are in a terrible situation right now trying to figure out what price point they can price their vehicles, because on one hand, they're in great competition. I mean, there are more car companies, more car models, probably than any other time in history right now, and so the car companies are in constant competition to not only create a hallmark, you know, brand and model, but more importantly, something that's priced right, unless you're going into the six-figure cars where the buyers of these don't give a rat's ass because, you know, a dollar to them is like a penny to, you know, a penny to us is like a dollar to them. So,
right.
But in the price bracket from, you know, anything from 20 to, call it 65,000, there's tremendous competition. So how do they juggle it?
I mean, there's competition. I mean, okay, so back in the day, doctors used to drive Buick Roadmasters. They were more expensive than the base model Cadillac, but it wasn't a Cadillac, so outwardly it looked good. Today, you got a broad spectrum of a certain model with, you know, three or four or five different iterations of that model, so that they can fill a lot of requirements in that model without breaking into the next model up. You know what I mean? It's like a shell game. You mean, do you want to drive that Buick Roadmaster, or do you want the Cadillac? You know, do you want a base model of a new sport utility vehicle, or do you want to go for the one that can fly, go off road, and tell your fortune? You know, it's whatever they're building. You're buying features now. You're buying features, and you're buying styling, and you know, tailor made, like you say. You got more choices now on interiors and so forth than you used to have in the old days. You used to have, back in the 50s, you used to have 2 and 3 color interiors, 4 color interiors, you know, and you had, for a difference of $25 or $100, depending on what the model was, you could get leather or you could get cloth. Now, think about all the choices that you have. You have pleather, you know, fake leather. You have real leather. You have cloth. You have a suede, a micro suede. Do you want the different color stitching on the seats? Do you want a two-tone interior? You didn't have those choices back in the day. So you get what you pay for. If you want to go uptown, you got to pay more money.
But I'll tell you, from a consumer standpoint, it reminds me of a story that I want to tell. And then I guess our half hour's up. We'll talk next week about the Mitsubishi Outlander. But here's a story that kind of lends itself to what we're talking about. Years ago, when I was in the international textile design business, I got a phone call from a gentleman named Roger Horchow, who was like the father of mail order catalogs, the Horchow collection.
I remember that.
And he was tremendously successful. He was a real innovator, and he was out of Dallas, Texas, and he called and he said, "I admire your designs, and I'd like you to come to Dallas and make a presentation. I want a Horchow exclusive bed linens collection." So I had a month to, you know, prepare for this meeting. It was so important. It would have put me on the map. And in fact, it did. And so I had my workmen do out of the fabrics every conceivable type of bedspread, dust ruffle, pillow sham, shams with ruffles, without ruffles, with single pleats, on and on and on. And then not only that, but sheets and pillowcases and throw pillows and on. And by the time I finished, I had so many wonderful things to show Roger Horchow, but over and above it, I brought down a portfolio of textile art for him to choose from, and I had something like 150 original designs on huge pieces of paper that I had done. So I get to Houston. I'm all nervous. I go into he's got this big office, big desk, sitting behind the desk, and I'm throwing all this stuff all over the place, showing him all this magnificent stuff that my company was capable of doing, and these magnificent designs, and then finally, I ran out of steam, and I took a breath, and he's still sitting behind the desk, and he looks up at me, and he says to me, "I want to tell you something. I need a tie. I needed a tie." And yesterday, he said, the Brooks Brothers catalog came in the mail. It had 64 pages of ties. And he said, "How many do you think I bought?" And I said, "A dozen." And he said, "No, I didn't buy any." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I didn't buy any because I was overwhelmed. I was too confused." He said, and I and that's the premise I built the Horchow collection on. We do one thing of each product because our people come to us and say, we rely on you for making the decision for us. Now, that's not how it is with cars anymore. I personally am overwhelmed. I mean, luckily, you know, we get to see a lot of cars, with our, being reviewers. But if I were to, and I have gone to the various dealerships to pick out a car, oh, I love this one, and then another dealership, oh, no, I like this one. You get overwhelmed with the choices. And then you get a car model that you like, and as you said, Bugsy, you get overwhelmed. Okay, what color, what interior, what top stitching? And it becomes like Christmas shopping. It's so overwhelming that you lose the joy. And this is something I don't think the automotive industry realizes. I mean, as you say, in the day when you went out, except for, brand loyalty, like, whether you're a Ford person or Chrysler, Chevrolet, whatever, you did rely on the company to say, well, this is what we're offering because these are the best choices. But now it's not that at all. Now it's, okay, what do you want? And I find it very difficult.
Yeah, it is. And it's going to, I don't know if it's going to get worse because a lot of companies are buying other companies and things are consolidating. So who knows where it's going to end up. John White from the Boston Globe, who you will remember fondly, at some point in time, they're going to build one big automobile for everybody.
And on that happy note, it's the end of our half hour. Thank you, John Bugsy Lawler, for joining us. Join us all the time. We love you. You are a wealth of information. And next week, Hezzy, I promise we'll talk about the Mitsubishi Outlander, a beautiful car. Remind me to tell you about the interior. We brought up the interior of cars. This car is magnificent on the inside. And, again, it's the price point is spectacular. So that's us for this weekend. Day. That's us for this Thursday.
Yeah.
Have a great weekend. Everybody stay safe, healthy, and happy.
Thank you, Lori, and thank you, Bugsy. All the best to both of you. Stay healthy.
Cheers.
All the best to John.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Sorry we didn't get a word in edgewise, Hez.
Well, it's all right. It's your show, so not a problem. Be well. Take care.
Love you. Bye-bye.
Love you back. All right. Well, there we have it. None other than Bugsy Lawler and, of course, our weekly guest, hostess, Lori Wiles, and her husband that we missed today, who's out, doing something. And John Wiles. So we'll speak to both of them tomorrow, next week rather. Always on Thursdays from 10 to 10:30. All right, so that's where we are now. And what we're going to do is we're going to try to catch up with some fascinating news, and hopefully you'll find that interesting. And let me just quickly look here. 1 second here. I guess hopefully. Okay. All right, 1 second here. Let me catch up here with the news. 1 second. All right. Well, all right. 1 second here. Let me see if we can get this. This is very interesting. Evidently, a special prosecutor by the name of Jack Smith has asked Fox News producer Abby Grossberg to hand over the new recordings of Ted Cruz talking about how the 2020 U.S. presidential election could be overturned. And should he get them? I'll tell you what. If Ted Cruz can be tied into this plot and the full conspiracy is laid out before America, we can finally be rid of not only the worst president of our era, but the worst senator, too. So let's get him. That's the thing. We're going to have to find out what's going on and what's happening here. And this is really going to be very interesting because the allegation is that Ted Cruz incited an insurrection to overthrow the U.S. government. So we'll see if all this really plays out. I really have no idea. It's going to be really, really fascinating. So much is going on. It's just a little bit too frightening the way all this thing is happening. Just don't quite get it. All right. Oh, God. Can you hear? All right, we'll just try to see if we can catch up here with some news. Bear with me a moment. I'm going to move over here. 1 second here. We'll see if we can get this done right. One moment. I'm having difficulty for some crazy reason. I didn't expect this, but I guess after a certain point in life, it seems Jerry Springer, remember him? He was a politician turned TV ringmaster. He died at the age of 79. He was a one-time mayor and news anchor. His namesake TV show featured a three-ring circus of dysfunctional families willing to bear all on a weekday afternoon, including brawls, obscenities, and blurred visions of nudity. He died today at the age of 79. At its peak, the Jerry Springer Show was a ratings powerhouse and a U.S. cultural pariah, synonymous with lurid drama and known for chair-throwing and bleep-filled arguments. The daytime talk show was a favorite American guilty pleasure over its 27-year run, and at one point topping Oprah Winfrey's show. Springer called it escapist entertainment, quote-unquote, while others saw the show as contributing to a dumbing-down decline in American social value. Well, anyway, Jerry's ability to connect with people was at the heart of his success in everything he tried, whether that was politics, broadcasting, or just joking with people on the street who wanted a photo or a word, said Gene Galvin, a family spokesperson and friend of Springer's since 1970. In a statement, she said, he's irreplaceable. Loss hurts immensely, but memories of his intellect, heart, and humor will live on. So Springer died peacefully at home in suburban Chicago after a brief illness, statement had said. On his Twitter profile, Springer jokingly declared himself as talk show host, ringmaster of civilization's end, quote. And he also often had told people, tongue-in-cheek, that his wish for them was, quote, may you never be on my show, end quote. This guy was hilarious. And after more than 4,000 episodes, the show ended in 2018, never straying from its core salaciousness. And some of its last episodes had such titles as Stripper Sex Turned Me Straight. Oh, this is hilarious stuff. And Stop Pimping My... I'm getting teary-eyed. Stop pimping my sister. This is totally hilarious. And hooking up with my therapist. These are some of the issues that he had on his air. Oh, my God. So in a Too Hot for TV video released as his Daily Show neared 7 million viewers in the late 1990s, Springer offered a defense against disgust. Look, he says, television does not and must not create values. It's merely a picture of all that's out there, the good, the bad, the ugly, Springer said, adding, quote, believe this, the politicians and companies that seek to control what each of us may watch are a far greater danger to America and our treasured freedom than any of our guests ever were or could be. He also contended that the people on his show volunteered to be subjected to whatever ridicule or humiliation awaited them. Gerald Norman Springer was born February 13 of 1944 in a London Underground Railway station being used as a bomb shelter. His parents, Richard and Margot, were German Jews who fled to England during the Holocaust, in which other relatives were killed in Nazi gas chambers. They arrived in the United States when their son was five and settled in the Queens, the borough of New York City, where Springer got his first Yankees baseball gear on his way to becoming a lifelong fan. He studied political science at Tulane University and got a law degree from Northwestern University. He was active in politics much of his adult life, among a run for governor of Ohio as recently as 2017. He entered the arena as an aide to Robert F. Kennedy's ill-fated 1968 presidential campaign. Springer, working for a Cincinnati law firm, ran unsuccessfully for Congress in 1970 before being elected to city council in 1971. In 1974, in what the Cincinnati Inquirer which shook Cincinnati's political community, end quote, Springer resigned. He cited, quote, very personal family considerations, end quote, but what he didn't mention was a vice probe involving prostitution. In a subsequent admission that could have been the basis for one of his future shows, Springer said he had paid prostitutes with personal checks. Then 30, he had married Mickey Velton the previous year. The couple had a daughter, Katie, and divorced in 1994. Then Springer quickly bounced back politically, winning a council seat in 1975. And serving as mayor in 1977. He later became a local television politics reporter with popular evening commentaries. He and co-anchor Norma Rashid eventually helped build NBC affiliate WLWT TV's broadcast into the Cincinnati market's top-rated news show. Springer began his talk show in 1991 with more of a traditional format, but after he left WT in 1993, it got a sleazy makeover. TV Guide ranked it number one on a list of worst shows in the history of television, but it was ratings gold. It made Springer a celebrity who would go on to host a liberal radio talk show with America's Got Talent, star in a movie called Ringmaster, and compete in Dancing with the Stars. All the joking I do with the show, I'm fully aware and thank God every day that my life has taken this incredible turn because of this silly show, Springer told Cincinnati Inquirer media reporter John Kiesewetter in 2011. Well in advance of Donald Trump's political rise from reality TV stardom, Springer mulled the Senate's run in 2003 that he surmised could draw on non-traditional voters, quote-unquote, people who, quote, believed most politics are bull, end quote. I connect with a whole bunch of people who probably connect more to me right now than to a traditional politician, Springer told the Associated Press at the time. He opposed the war on Iraq and favored expanding public health care, but ultimately did not run. Springer also spoke often of the country he came to at the age of five as, quote, a beacon of light for the rest of the world, end quote. Continuing, he says, I have no other motivation but to say I love this country, Springer said to a Democratic gathering in 2003. Springer hosted a nationally syndicated Judge Jerry show in 2019 and continued to speak out on whatever was on his mind in a podcast, but his power to shock had dimmed in the new era of reality television and combative cable TV talk shows. Quote, he was lapped not only by other programs, but by real life. David Biancooley, or truly a television historian, a professor at Monmouth University, said in 2018, despite the limits Springer's show put on his political aspirations, he embraced its legacy. In a 2003 fundraising infomercial ahead of a possible U.S. Senate run the following year, Springer referenced a quote by then National Review commentator Jonah Goldberg, who warned of new people brought to the polls by Springer, including Jack Jord yokels, hicks, weirdos, pervs, and whatnots, end quote. In the infomercial, Springer referred to the quote and talked about wanting to reach out to, quote, regular folks who weren't born with a silver spoon in their mouth, end quote. Sewell, a former Associated Press journalist who retired in 2021, was the primary writer of this obituary. Associated Press journalist David Bowder in New York and former Associated Press journalist Andrew Welsh Huggins in Columbus, Ohio, contributed reporting. Wow, unbelievable. Okay, we'll see what happens here. It's amazing how life goes on. But he was phenomenal. And I thought his show was hilarious. What can I tell you? And this is really quite interesting. It's a powerful new obesity drug which is poised to upend weight loss care. As a growing number of overweight Americans clamor for Ozempic and Wegovy, drugs touted by celebrities and on TikTok to pare pounds, and even more powerful obesity medicines poised to upend treatment. Tirzepatide, an Eli Lilly and Company drug approved to treat type 2 diabetes under the brand name Mounjaro, helped people with a disease who were overweight or had obesity lose up to 16% of their body weight or more than 34 pounds over nearly 17 months, the company said on Thursday. The late stage study of the drug for weight loss adds to earlier evidence that similar participants without diabetes lost up to 22% of their body weight over that period with weekly injections of the drug. For a typical patient on the highest dose, that meant shedding more than 50 pounds. Having diabetes makes it notoriously difficult to lose weight, said Nadia Ahmad, Lilly's medical director of obesity clinical development, which means the recent results are especially significant. We have not seen this degree of weight reduction, she said. Based on the new results, which have not yet been published in full, company officials said they will finalize an application to the United States Food and Drug Administration for fast-track approval to sell tirzepatide for chronic weight management, a decision that could come later this year. A company spokeswoman would not confirm whether the drug would be marketed for weight loss in the United States under a different brand name. If approved for weight loss, tirzepatide could become the most effective drug to date in an arsenal of medications that are transforming the treatment of obesity, which affects more than 4 in 10 American adults and is linked to dozens of diseases that can lead to disability or death. If everybody who had obesity in this country lost 20% of their body weight, we would be taking patients off all of those medications for reflux, for diabetes, hypertension, said Dr. Caroline Apovian, a director of the Center for Weight Management and Wellness at Brigham and Women's Hospital. We would not be sending patients for stent replacement, end quote. Well, industry analysts predict that tirzepatide could become one of the top-selling drugs ever, with annual sales topping $50 billion. It is expected to outpace Novo Nordisk's Ozempic, a diabetic drug used so commonly to shed pounds that comedian Jimmy Kimmel joked about it at the Oscars, and Wegovy, a version of the drug also known as semaglutide, approved for weight loss in 2021. Together, those drugs made nearly $10 billion in 2022, with prescriptions continuing to soar, company reports show. In separate trials, tirzepatide has resulted in greater weight loss than semaglutide, whose users shed about 15% of their body weight over 16 months. A head-to-head trial comparing the two drugs is planned. Mounjaro was first approved to treat diabetes last year, and since then, thousands of patients have obtained drug from doctors and telehealth providers who prescribed it off-label to help them slim down. In California, Matthew Barlow, a 48-year-old health technology executive, said he has lost more than 100 pounds since November by using Mounjaro and changing his diet. Psychologically, you don't want to eat, said Barlow. Now I can eat 2 bites of a dessert and be satisfied. Rather than relying solely on diet, exercise, and willpower to reduce weight, tirzepatide and other new drugs target the digestive and chemical pathways that underlie obesity, suppressing appetite and blunting cravings for food. They have entirely changed the landscape, said Dr. Amy Rothberg, a University of Michigan endocrinologist who directs a virtual weight loss and diabetes program. Research has shown that with diet and exercise alone, about a third of people will lose 5% or more of their body weight, said Dr. Louis Arone, director of the Comprehensive Weight Loss Center at Weill Cornell Medicine. In the latest tirzepatide trial, more than 86% of patients using the higher dose of the drug lost at least 5% of their body weight. More than half of that on that dose lost at least 15%, the company said. The obesity medications help overcome a biological mechanism that kicks in when people diet, triggering a coordinated effort by the body to prevent weight loss. That is a real physical phenomenon, Arone said. There are a number of hormones that respond to reduced calorie intake. Ozempic and Wegovy are two versions of semaglutide. That drug mimics a key gut hormone known as GLP-1 that is activated after people eat, boosting the release of insulin and slowing release of sugar from the liver. It delays digestion and reduces appetite, making people feel full longer. Tirzepatide is the first drug that uses the action of two hormones, GLP-1 and GIP. For greater effects. It also targets the chemical signals sent from the gut to the brain, curbing cravings and thoughts of food. Though the drug appears safe, they can cause side effects, some serious. Most common reactions include diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, constipation, and stomach pain. And some users have developed pancreatitis or inflammation of the pancreas. Others have had gallbladder problems. Mounjaro's product description warns that it could cause thyroid tumors, including cancer. My God, there are other downsides. Versions of semaglutide have been on the market for several years, but the long-term effects of taking drugs that override human metabolism are not yet clear. Early evidence suggests that when people stop taking the medications, they gain the weight back. Plus, the medications are expensive and in recent months hard to get because of intermittent shortages. Wegovy is priced at about $1,300 a month. Mounjaro, used for diabetes, starts at about $1,000 a month. Apovian said that only about 20 to 30% of patients with private insurance in her practice find the medications are covered. Some insurers who previously paid for the drugs are enacting new rules, requiring 6 months of documented lifestyle changes or a certain amount of weight loss for continued coverage. Medicare is largely prohibited from paying for weight loss drugs, though there have been efforts by drug makers and advocates for Congress to change that. Still, experts say that the striking effects of tirzepatide, along with Ozempic, Wegovy, and other drugs, underscore that losing weight is not merely a matter of willpower. Like high blood pressure, which affects about half of U.S. adults and is managed with medication, obesity should be viewed as a chronic disease, not a character flaw, Aroni emphasized. It remains to be seen what effect new drug treatment will have to pervasive bias against people with obesity, said Rebecca Poole, a professor in the Rudd Center for Food Policy and Health, who studies weight stigma. And U.S. Culture has deep-rooted beliefs about body weight and physical appearance that are hard to change, she said. Weight stigma could persist or worsen if taking medication is equated with taking the easy way out or not trying hard enough, she said. The Associated Press Health and Science Department receives support from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute Science and Educational Media Group. The Associated Press is solely responsible for all content. Well, 1 second. One moment here. One moment here. Let me just see what the time is here. Okay, we're good on time. All right. This comes from the Associated Press. Past Fox firings carry lessons for the network after Carlson. This is written by David Bowder. So before ousting Tucker Carlson, Fox News had twice fired wildly popular hosts, and both times the network recovered better than the stars it cut loose. Fox's dismissal of Glenn Beck in 2011 and Bill O'Reilly in 2017 offer lessons in what the post-Carlson fallout might be. Carlson was let go on Monday, less than a week after Fox agreed to pay Dominion Voting System $787 million for airing bogus claims of voter fraud following the 2020 general election. Fox's two most popular programs last year, Carlson being one of them, were the replacement for Beck and O'Reilly. It seems like the parts are interchangeable, said SiriusXM and CNN personality Michael Smirkanish. They built a machine over there that seems to function even when the pistons are replaced. Still, Carlson's ability to connect with supporters of former President Donald Trump could benefit him wherever he lands. Beck has a sensation, or was a sensation, at Fox during the first term of former President Barack Obama. He spun intricate conspiracy theories before it was fashionable and sparked an advertising boycott after saying that Obama had a deep-seated hatred for white people, end quote. And viewers flocked to his marginal time slot, 5 p.m. Eastern, in numbers that rivaled prime time. There were signs that Beck was fading when then Fox News chief Roger Ailes cut him loose in April of 2011. Ailes famously told the Associated Press at the time that half of the headlines say he's been canceled. The other half say he quit. We're pretty happy with both of them. Beck was hailed as an elder statesman when Carlson brought him on as a guest last month on the night Trump was indicted, where he predicted the U.S. would be at war with Russia, China, and Iraq by 2025. Ailes replaced Beck with a panel show, The Five, quote unquote, with four conservative pundits and one liberal kicking around the stories of the day. In 2022, the show averaged 3.4 million nightly viewers, more than Beck at its peak, and was the top-rated cable show of the year, the Nielsen Company said. O'Reilly's No Spin Zone was essentially the face of Fox News for several years before he was fired on April 2017 following an investigation into harassment allegations. He was replaced by Carlson, a cable news journeyman whose angry, grievance-based program made him the most influential voice in cable news. His ideas were echoed by many Republican politicians, and there was talk of him being a future candidate too. O'Reilly now hosts a podcast, and Beck was the sixth most popular radio talk show in the country, but neither has the influence they had when they were on Fox, said Michael Harrison, the publisher of Talkers magazine. At Fox, the platform is king, Harrison said, not the on-air personalities. While Fox has shed big-name hosts like with little damage in the past, the ouster of Carlson comes at a precarious moment for the network, said Nicole Hemmer, a Vanderbilt University professor and author of Partisans, Conservative Revolutionaries Who Remade American Politics in the 1990s. Carlson was the person who best excelled at exciting the base of the Republican Party. She said, Smirconish noticed the number of callers on his own talk show who said they would miss Carlson's ability to challenge groupthink. Quote, if Carlson now begins attacking Fox as, quote, corporate media, end quote, that despises its Trump-supporting viewers, he could cause the network to begin bleeding viewers, end quote, as it briefly did after the 2020 election, Hemmer said. Carlson hasn't talked about his firing and didn't return a query from the Associated Press on Tuesday. Carlson heavily embraced some conspiracy theories, particularly surrounding the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the United States Capitol. His opposition to U.S. involvement in the Ukraine war received Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov brought up Carlson's firing at the United Nations on Tuesday. Quote, it's curious news, Lavrov said. Quote, what is this related to? One can only guess, but clearly the wealth of news, of views in the American information space has suffered as a result. The day he was fired, Carlson was nearly invisible on the Fox News primetime lineup that he used to dominate. We're not talking about Tucker, end quote, former colleague Sean Hannity said in one of the two very brief mentions of Carlson's name on Fox News on Monday night. In contrast, his ouster was the lead story on ABC, CBS, and NBC News evening newscasts. Fox hasn't discussed its reason or reasons for cutting ties with Carlson, but as the Dominion case illustrated, the spread of conspiracy theories has made Fox legally vulnerable. A new host who reflects the Fox audience's conservative philosophy, but is less controversial, could also be more popular with advertisers and thus more lucrative. Quote, people are creatures of habit, end quote, conservative talk show host Eric Erickson said. Quote, Fox will offer another host who speaks into the audience's concerns. There'll be a dip, just like after O'Reilly, but I expect the host will be competent enough to earn the audience's trust quickly. Carlson was named to replace O'Reilly on the day O'Reilly was fired. It may take some time for Carlson's replacement to be known. Fox took a year using guest host before naming Jesse Waters as its 7 p.m. host last year. Waters was an immediate hit, and Fox learned that the audience liked to be part of the selection process. It makes Waters an obvious candidate to move from 7 to 8 p.m., as Carlson did in replacing O'Reilly. In addition to Beck and O'Reilly, other people who have left Fox in recent years, Megyn Kelly, Shepard Smith, Chris Wallace haven't reached the same heights elsewhere in terms of audience interest. Will Carlson, who turns 54 next month, have another act in media? Every one of the journalists who left reemerged in diminished positions, Smirkanish had said. Quote, I expect that will be the same with him. I think he will have a better shot than the others, but I don't think he will be at the level he was on Friday night. Very interesting analysis, to say the least. So, one second, see if we can go on. One moment here. And this is really quite interesting. A writer tells a jury in a lawsuit, a trial, that Donald Trump raped me. This is written by Jennifer Peltz and Michael R. Sisak. Seems at first she thought that helping Donald Trump shop for a woman's lingerie gift at a luxury department store would simply be a funny New York thing, quote unquote. Even when, according to E. Jean Carroll, the then businessman motioned her to a dressing room as they dared each other to try on a see-through bodysuit. She imagined something like a Saturday Night Live sketch she'd written. But soon, my whole reason for being alive in that moment was to get out of that room, Carroll testified Wednesday in the trial of her rape lawsuit. I'm here because Donald Trump raped me, and when I wrote about it, he said it didn't happen. He lied and shattered my reputation, and I'm here to try to get my life back, Carroll told jurors. As she took the stand to give testimony that sometimes brought her to tears, Trump, from afar, repeated his insistence that Carroll's claim of a 1996 rape is utter fiction. He called the case a made-up scam, quote-unquote, and more, quote, this is a fraudulent and false story, witch hunt, end quote, Trump wrote on his social media platform, Truth Social. His comments prompted the judge to warn Trump's lawyers that he could bring more legal problems upon himself. Trump hasn't attended the trial thus far, but his lawyers said Tuesday he still could decide to testify. The trial comes as Trump again seeks the Republican nomination for president and weeks after he pleaded not guilty to unrelated criminal charges that evokes payments made to silence a porn actor who said she had a sexual encounter with him. Carroll, a 79-year-old former Vice columnist, was largely a matter of fact on the witness stand, so much so that after she wept while telling jurors that, quote, being able to get my day in court is everything to me, end quote, she rapidly composed herself and declined to take a break. I'm not going to sit here and cry and waste everybody's time, she said. Carroll testified that she crossed paths with Trump at the revolving door to Bergdorf Goodman on an unspecified Thursday evening in the spring of 1996. At the time, she was writing a long-running advice column in Elle magazine, having also written for Saturday Night Live, SNL. Trump was a real estate magnate and social figure in New York. She said he asked her advice about selecting a gift for a woman, and she was delighted to oblige. As an advice columnist, to have Trump ask for a gift guidance, quote, was a wonderful prospect, and Carroll figured she would end up with a funny story, she said. She testified that she suggested a hat, but he pivoted to lingerie, and soon they were bantering about the bodysuit and flirting. She went along, laughing even as he closed the door to the dressing room, perhaps even as he pushed her against a wall. But then, she alleges, Trump stamped his mouth into hers, yanked down her tights, and shoved his hand and then his penis inside her while she struggled against him. She said she finally kneed him off her and fled. Carol said that for decades she told no one except two friends because she was afraid Trump would retaliate. because she, quote, thought it was my fault, end quote, and because she thought many people blame rape victims for what happened to them. The alleged attack happened long before the hashtag MeToo movement forced a reckoning with how sexual assault victims are treated by law enforcement and the public. Carol has said hashtag MeToo fueled her decision to come forward in a 2019 memoir and accompanying magazine excerpt. The Associated Press typically does not name people who say they have been sexually assaulted unless they come forward publicly, as Carol has done. Trump, who's 76, has said he wasn't at the store with Carol and had no clue who she was when she first aired the whole story publicly. He has said she was totally lying, quote unquote, and called the case a hoax, end quote unquote, and a lie, quote unquote, and a complete con job, quote unquote. Trump's comments launched a staggering, quote unquote, onslaught of hateful and occasionally threatening messages toward her, according to Carol, whose suit also includes a defamation claim. At court, as court was about to begin on Wednesday, Trump used Truth Social to vent his feelings again about the case and alluded to a DNA issue that Judge Lewis A. Kaplan had ruled can't be part of the case. He wasn't pleased. Trump, the judge said, appeared to be addressing his supporters and the jury, quote, about stuff that has no business being spoken about, Kaplan called Trump's post, quote, a public statement that, on the face of it, seems entirely inappropriate, end quote. Trump attorney Joe Tacopina noted that jurors are told not to follow any news or online commentary about it, but he said he would ask Trump, quote, to refrain from any further posts about this case, end quote. Quote, I hope you're more successful, end quote, Kaplan said, adding that Trump, quote, may or may not be tampering with a new source of potential liability, end quote. Carol is due to continue testifying on Thursday, that when Trump's lawyers likely will get their chance to question her. A federal lawsuit seeks unspecified damages and a retraction of his allegedly defamatory comments. She never pursued criminal charges. Meanwhile, the judge decided on Wednesday that the trial won't delve into funding that Carol's lawyers got from American Future Republic, an organization funded by LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman. Trump's lawyers had argued that the money raised questions about Carol's credibility. Kaplan concluded there was, quote, nothing there, end quote. And after hearing that Trump's son, Eric, had just tweeted criticism of the funding, he again advised Tacopina to speak with Donald Trump. Tacopina has asserted that Carol sued to get money and tried to punish Trump politically. Carol, a registered Democrat, testified that she voted for his Democratic opponent in 2016 and 2020, but said that has nothing to do with her lawsuit. Quote, I'm not settling a political score at all, end quote, she said. I'm settling a personal score. Well, so we'll see where that goes. This is absolutely amazing. This is another story. Actor Danny Masterson, the woman raped women, a prosecutor claims. This is written by Andrew Dalton. Actor Danny Masterson drugged, then raped three women at his Hollywood area home between 2001 and 2003, a prosecutor told jurors on Monday in his opening statement in the retrial of the star of That 70s Show. Deputy District Attorney Reinhold Miller said that Masterson put substances into drinks that he gave to a longtime girlfriend and two women he knew through friend circles around the Church of Scientology, all of whom Masterson is charged with raping. The evidence will show that they were drugged. end quote, Mueller said, told the jury, the defense denies such evidence exists. Direct discussion of drugging was missing from the first trial, which ended in a mistrial when a jury deadlocked on all three counts, with Mueller instead having to imply it through the testimony of the women, who said they were woozy, disoriented, and at times unconscious on the nights that they described the actor raping them. But Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Charlene F. Olmedo is allowing the direct assertion at the second trial. Masterson's attorney, Philip Cohen, said in a defense opening statement that those hazy stories and assertions are all the prosecution has, and he told jurors there is no drugging charge in this case. Attorneys for both sides acknowledged that there is no forensic evidence of any substances Masterson may have given the women because the police investigation that led to the two trials did not begin until about 15 years after the events. But Mueller said he will call an analyst from the police toxicology unit, quote, who will tell you how some of the most common drug-facilitated sexual assaults, how some of the most common date rape drugs work, and how quickly they're metabolized and what side effects look like. Cohen responded that a toxicologist can come in opine to whatever they want, but there is no toxicology report. There's no urine, no blood work, no DNA. Cohen was not allowed to refer to testimony from the first trial, something Olmedo admonished him several times for doing, but he said he expected testimony this time would show that one of the women Masterson is charged with raping watched him during the allegedly drugged drink he gave her. Cohen told jurors that another of the women, a young actress who spent an evening alone with Masterson at his home in 2003, made no mention of drugging at the time. Quote, she spoke to her mom about how her date with Masterson went. She spoke to her friends. She did not ever say to one person, I was drugged. Never, Cohen said. She could only mention thinking she had been drugged years later after the investigation began, Cohen said. This and many other similarities between the women's stories come from them talking to each other and cross-pollinating, quote-unquote, the details of their accounts, something they did multiple times even after the detective in the case warned them that such communication could taint the case against Masterson, Cohen had said. Well, the drugging allegations had echoes of the trial of Bill Cosby, where women testified to similar experiences. Cosby's conviction after two trials of his own was permanently thrown out by Pennsylvania's highest court. The Associated Press did not typically name people who say they have been sexually assaulted. Masterson was 47, could get 45 years in prison if convicted. Mueller also told jurors that the women did not immediately go to authorities because they were told not to by officials in the Church of Scientology, and they were told what happened to them was not rape. Masterson is a prominent member of the church. All three women are former members. The church said in a statement after the women's testimony in the first trial that, quote, it has no policy prohibiting or discouraging members from reporting criminal conduct of Scientologists or of anyone to law enforcement, end quote. In another difference between the first trial, Olmedo is allowing expert witnesses to testify on those policies. Cohen said that prosecution expert Claire Headley, a former member of the church's leadership group, is someone who works, quote, to rid the world of Scientology, rid people of Scientology, end quote, and told jurors they were going to, quote, hear tremendous bias, end quote, in her testimony. The expert on the defense witness list is her father-in-law, a current high-level Scientologist. Dalia Rimini, a former Scientologist who has become the church's most prominent detractor on social media and through a TV series she hosted featuring dissident ex-members sat in the front row of the courtroom in support of Masterson's accusers. Masterson, who has been free on bail since his 2020 arrest, sat at the defense table with a large coterie of supporters behind him, many if not all church members who also sat through his first trial. They include his wife, model and actor Bijou Phillips, his sister-in-law, and One Day at a Time actor Mackenzie Phillips, and his brother Malcolm in the Middle actor Christopher Masterson. Oh my goodness. One moment. Unbelievable. All right, we'll just have to see what else is going on. Amazing. Literally amazing. Okay, bear with me a second here. One second. All right, let me see if I can get this. One second, I don't know what's happening here. Let me just see if this is coming up. One moment. I don't know what on it means. One second. I don't know why this is coming up like this. Unbelievable. Wow. Oh. Okay, got it. So hopefully this will work. 1 minute here. Okay, let's see if this goes through. Didn't go through for some crazy reason. I don't understand this. One moment. We're going to try this differently. Hopefully this will work. All right. Okay, I think we got this working at long last. All right, it seems that the ailing Erdogan of Turkey is trying to project health in a video link appearance with Putin. Let me just quickly see. For some reason, I'm having trouble with this for some reason. Let me see if this picks up right. I don't know what's going on here. Let's see if this goes through. I know I'm having problems here somehow. this is really weird. Let's see if this happens, if this comes through. Evidently, Zelensky of Ukraine and Xi of China have spoken for the first time since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said that he and Chinese leader Xi Jinping had had a, quote, long and meaningful, end quote, phone conversation yesterday, their first known contact since Russia invaded Ukraine more than a year ago. So Russia, the Russians have pounded the frontline positions in Bakhmut, Ukraine military said. The Russian forces pounded the city of Bakhmut, the months-old focal point of their attempts to capture the eastern Ukrainian industrial region of Donbas. And the head of Russia's Wagner mercenary force said that Ukrainian troops were pouring in ahead of an inevitable counteroffensive, quote unquote. The general staff of Ukraine's armed forces in a report on Facebook said that fighting gripped Bakhmut and nearby areas. It said that Russian forces had failed to advance on two villages to the northwest. At least a dozen localities came under Russian fire. Separately, Serhiy Sheravatyuk, a spokesman for Ukraine's eastern group of forces, told national television on Wednesday, past 24 hours, Russian forces had attacked 324 times using artillery and multiple rocket launchers. The Russians are destroying buildings in Bakhmut to prevent our soldiers from using them as fortifications, Sheravatyuk had said. After Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke to his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, Franz Venkat's Ukraine correspondent Gulliver Cragg commented on the two leaders' first conversation since the Russian invasion. Quote, Ukrainians are just very, very diplomatic with the Chinese. They can be extremely sharp-tongued sometimes with their Western allies, but with the Chinese, it's very much the standard diplomatic language, end quote, Cragg had noted. Quote, the Ukrainians, I think, still hope that China's role in this conflict could be a positive one. They fear that China might start arming the Russians. So they want to get the Chinese on side, on their side, partly with a view to a possible mediation. Partly, of course, they are also thinking about the contributions that China will be able to make to the eventual reconstruction of Ukraine after hostilities cease. Quote, but it has to be said that the page that China is currently on is very much not the one that the Ukrainians would like to be on, Krag had added. U.S. and European officials on Wednesday toured Ukraine's southern port of Izmail. That's important in bringing Ukrainian grain to the world, and could become critical if a deal with Russia to allow grain exports from Ukrainian Black Sea ports expires. From Izmail, which has been upgraded since the start of the war with the help of the United States and other funding, grain is taken by barge down a branch of the Danube through Romania to its Black Sea port of Constanta for shipment onward. The U.S. Ambassador Bridget Brink told Associated Press, after looking over the port facilities with Ukrainian and European Union officials, as well as Ukrainian grain companies, that they were exploring ways to increase the exports from the Danube ports. Brussels welcomed Wednesday's conversation between Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, thought to be their first call since Russia invaded Ukraine. It is an important, long overdue first step by China in exercising its responsibilities as a member of the United Nations Security Council, said the European Commission spokesman, Eric Maimer. China's leadership needs to use its influence to bring Russia to end its war of aggression, restore Ukraine's territorial integrity and respect its sovereignty as a basis for a just peace. After Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke to his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, the France 24 chief foreign editor Robert Parsons commented on the two leaders' first conversation since the start of the Russo-Ukrainian war. Quote, China is a very big player in this, and also it's Russia's main strategic ally, Parsons noted. Ukraine would like to get China involved if it could see any advantage for itself. It's interesting that the Chinese didn't refer to Russia in their statement about the talks, whereas clearly the Ukrainians have done. Quote, but they both talked about sovereignty and territorial integrity, and Ukraine, I think, will see room for maneuver there, room to try and get the Chinese to be more proactive on their behalf. The Chinese, for their part, quite clearly do not want to antagonize Russia. For China, Parsons continued, the Zelensky-Xi conversation was about more than anything else, was just asserting itself on the global stage, just saying, quote, we are an equal with the United States. A Ukrainian reporter working as a fixer for Italy's Repubblica daily, that's a newspaper, has been shot dead by snipers in southern Ukraine, and his Italian colleague was wounded, the newspaper said on Wednesday. Our correspondent Corrado Zunino and his fixer Bogdan Bitic were victims of an ambush by Russian snipers today on the outskirts of Kherson in southern Ukraine, the Repubblica publication had said. Bitic, unfortunately, did not make it and died. He leaves behind his wife and his son, Corrado, who was wounded in the shoulder, who was in the civil hospital in Kherson, he said. Now, both reporters who had extensively covered the conflicts were wearing bulletproof vests with press written on them, it added. Well, Ukraine's military will get the weaponry it needs in time for an upcoming counteroffensive against invading Russian forces, a top U.S. general in Europe told Congress on Wednesday. General Christopher Cavoli, the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, cited as an example that more than 98% of the combat vehicles promised to Kyiv had already been delivered. Quote, I'm very confident that we have delivered the material that they need and will continue a pipeline to sustain their operations as well, Cavoli had told a hearing at the House Armed Services Committee. The Kremlin warned on Wednesday that Russia could widen the list of foreign companies subject to temporary asset seizure in case of the expropriation of Russian assets abroad. The comments came after Putin signed a presidential decree approving the takeover of operations of two Western energy groups in Russia, Finland's Fortum and Germany's Uniper, and threatened to do the same with others. Quote, if necessary, the list of companies could be expanded, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters a day after President Vladimir Putin signed a decree allowing asset seizures. Well, the Ukrainian government on Wednesday launched a new initiative meant to streamline and promote innovation in the development of drones and other technologies that have been critical in the war with Russia. As part of the initiative dubbed Brave One, the government hopes to bring state, military, and private sector developers working on defense issues together with a tech cluster that would give Ukraine a battlefield advantage. Quote, considering the enemy that is right next to us and its scale, we definitely need to develop the military technology so that we can defend ourselves, Mykhailo Fedorov, Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation, had said. China is not a neutral player, but still wants to be a global peacemaker. So as Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke on the phone with Ukrainian counterpart Volodymyr Zelensky for the first time since the start of the Russo-Ukrainian war, it's clear that Xi is once again trying to play the mediator, France 24's Yena Li reported from Beijing. quote, it's important to contextualize this conversation. It comes 1 month after she visited Moscow, 2 months into the 12-point position paper published by Beijing, Lee continued. On the Chinese side, they call it the Ukrainian crisis and not the Ukrainian war and not Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So Beijing is clearly not a neutral player in all of this, but it still wants to be a global peacemaker. Well, the jailed Russian dissident Navalny says he may face a life sentence. Imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny said on Wednesday that he was facing new extremism and terrorism charges that could keep him behind bars for life as authorities set the stage for a new trial against the Kremlin's leading critic. Navalny said by video link from prison during the hearing that the extremism charges, which he rejected as absurd, quote unquote, could land him in prison for 30 years. He noted that an investigator had told him that he also would face a separate military court trial on terrorism charges that could potentially carry a life sentence, adding to a sardonic note that the charges imply that, quote, I'm conducting terror attacks while sitting in prison, quote. His top ally, Ivan Zhdanov, said that investigators were trying to link the terrorism charges against Navalny to a bombing that killed a well-known Russian military blogger earlier this month. The Hungarian government has called for a cease in neighboring Ukraine is, quote, cynical, end quote, given large swaths of the country being occupied by invading Russian forces. The U.S. ambassador to Budapest, David Pressman, said on Wednesday. The U.S. envoy did not mention Prime Minister Viktor Orban by name, but Hungary's leader has repeatedly called for a ceasefire and peace talks, a move critics have said would amount to surrendering chunks of Ukraine's territory to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Quote, when we hear politicians advocate for appeasement masquerading as peace, let's be very clear. One man can make peace today. If Putin stops fighting, the war ends. If Ukraine stops fighting, Ukraine ends. Pressman told a panel discussion in Budapest, according to a transcript of his remarks released by the United States Embassy. Ukraine has repatriated 44 prisoners of war from Russian custody, a senior Ukrainian presidential advisor said on Wednesday. And Andriy Yermak wrote on the Telegram messaging app that 42 were soldiers and 2 were civilians, and that some of those freed had injuries sustained during torture. He named a China ambassador after the Xi call. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appointed a new ambassador to Beijing on Wednesday after its first call with Chinese leader Xi Jinping since Moscow's invasion. Pavel Ryabkin, who previously headed the Ministry of Strategic Industries of Ukraine, was named Kyiv's new envoy to China, according to a decree on the president's website. Ukraine has not had an ambassador to China since February 2021. Russia says no progress towards extending a grain deal. Russia warned on Wednesday that no progress had been made towards meeting the conditions it had set for extending a Ukraine grain export deal aimed at easing the global food crisis. The Black Sea Grain Initiative has been in place since last July and allows Ukrainian grains to be exported after they were blocked amid the conflict with Russia. The exports via the Black Sea are vital for world food security. But Moscow has repeatedly threatened to block the continuation of the agreement, which is up for its third renewal. Its obstacles to a parallel agreement on unhindered Russian food and fertilizer exports are not removed. Well, Russia's Lula has doubled down on the contentious Ukraine stance in Spain. 2016's Brazilian President Lula met Spain's prime minister on Wednesday for talks aimed at making progress on an intercontinental trade deal. But his differences with the Western alliance on the war in Ukraine remains evident. Lula and Spanish Prime Minister Sanchez told a news conference after the signing of bilateral agreements on Wednesday that the warmth between the two left-wing leaders was evident, but their divergent views on Ukraine left a vote, or rather a note of tension in the room. Quote, there is no doubt that we condemn Russia's violation of Ukraine's rights with the invasion, but it is of no use to say who is right or wrong. The war must be stopped. She and Zelensky speak for the first time since the war has started. So Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he and Chinese President and leader Xi Jinping had a long and meaningful phone conversation on Wednesday, the first known contact since Russia's invasion of Ukraine more than a year ago. The phone call, which officials said lasted nearly an hour, is a significant development in efforts to resolve the conflict. It comes 2 months after Beijing, which has long been aligned with Russia and said it wanted to act as a peace mediator in the war against Ukraine, and after she visited Moscow last month. Quote, I believe that this call, as well as the appointment of Ukraine's ambassador to China, will give a powerful impetus to the development of our bilateral relations. End quote, Zelensky said in a Facebook post without elaborating. Moscow is accusing Kyiv of undermining the peace attempts. Moscow on Wednesday accused Kyiv of undermining any peace attempts in its reaction to the first call between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping since Russia's offensive. China has sought to portray itself as a neutral party in the Ukrainian conflict. Despite strong ties with Russia, it has not condemned Moscow's offensive. Ukrainian authorities and its Western minders have already shown their ability to mess up any peace initiative, the Russian Foreign Ministry had said. Moscow noted what it casts as, quote, the readiness of the Chinese aid to make efforts to establish a negotiated process. Melitopol is likely a target for Ukrainian spring offensive. The plans for a Ukrainian counteroffensive are top secret, but the likely first target is Melitopol, the largest occupied city in Zaporizhia, in the Zaporizhia region. A little over a year ago, that the Russian offensive in the Zaporizhia region was stopped, but the shelling has never stopped since then. Once and CAT correspondent in Ukraine, Gulliver Krag, reports after spending time with the remaining adults in the city. See if we can hear this. One second.
Spring has come to Oryhiv, and with it, expectations of a spring counteroffensive.
Everyone's waiting to go out and liberate our territory, and that's what keeps their spirits up, the hope that soon we'll go for it.
The plans are top secret, but a likely first target is Melitopol, the largest occupied city in Zaporizhia region.
If we take Melitopol, we can take Mariupol and Berdyansk, and then we'll have them cut off from Crimea. The occupied part of Kherson region will be surrounded, and they'll have no options. We'll have an open road to Crimea.
It was just outside Oryhiv a little over a year ago that the Russian offensive in Zaporizhia region was stopped, but the shelling has never ceased since then. This school was bombed 2 weeks ago. All Oryhiv's children had long since been evacuated, though. The remaining adults spend much of their time in the basement of this other school, now a drop-in center offering food, showers, and electricity.
President Inkun, I hear that every day, just not on the news, but with my own ears.
We work until 5:30 because the curfew here starts at 6. Then we get on our bikes. They're shelling, we're riding home. Every day it's the same. We would like things to go faster. We're a bit tired of this. It would be good if they soon at least push them back a bit. Give us a breather.
These are all people who made up their minds long ago not to leave. And so they wait. For Ukraine's next move.
Well, let me just see if there's anything else that we can cover with you before we end the show. one second. One second here. One second. I think that might be it. Let me just check if there's anything else. Second, see if there's something else here that we missed. One moment here. Well, this is really quite interesting because it involves Russia's Wagner Group and in a grab for power and gold. And where are they doing it? It's in the Sudan. This comes from Deutsche Welle, written by Philip Obagi Jr. Seems that Russian paramilitary group Wagner operates a gold processing plant in Sudan and has been accused of involvement in the country's recent conflicts. While the Russians buy almost everything, Omar Sharif, a miner in the northeastern Sudanese town of Al-Ibaidiyah, this was told to Deutsche Welle shortly before the current conflict between Sudan's armed forces and the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF paramilitary group, began. Sharif is one of the dozens of artisanal miners in Al-Ibaidiyah, a town on the banks of the Nile River, located about 248 miles north of the capital of Khartoum, who labor in searing heat to cut gold from rocks in the desert. They separate the gold from the rocks using chemical processes involving toxic substances like cyanide, lithium, and mercury that can harm both the miners and the environment. Most of the gold ends up in a processing plant about 16 kilometers away, run by a company owned by the founder of Russia's paramilitary Wagner Group, Yevgeny Prigozhin, a close friend of Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Russians can pay close to $4,000 for a truckload of gold, says Sharif. They are often desperate to buy everything. So the Wagner Group first surfaced in Sudan back in 2017 at the invitation of then-President Omar al-Bashir following a meeting between the Sudanese dictator and Putin in Moscow. The private military organization set up Meroe Gold, a Prigozhin-controlled company that was later sanctioned by the United States to run its operations in the African nation. Shortly afterward, it began to explore Sudan's gold resources. In the process, Wagner began to build a relationship with General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, commonly known as Hemedti, and his paramilitary RSF, members of the RSF, according to locals in Al-Ibadiyya, gave protection to Russian merchants who sought to buy gold from miners. The Russian-owned gold processing plant is also said to be guarded by several RSF paramilitaries who work closely with Russian security personnel believed to be from the Wagner Group. And for more than 4 years, we've seen RSF soldiers working closely with the Russians, Mustafa El-Tahir, who has been mining gold in Al-Abadiyya since 2018, advised Deutsche Welle, anywhere the Russians go, RSF goes with them. So Wagner maintained its relationship with Hemedti after the Sudanese pro-democracy movement toppled al-Bashir in 2019. Its ouster paved the way for a transitional civilian government, and that relationship appeared to be instrumental in overthrowing the civilian-led government nearly 2 years later, following the coup allegedly supported by Russia. Army General Abdel Fattah Burhan took over as military leader, making Hemedti his deputy. Well, playing with gold bullion. Since the military's return to power, Wagner's collaboration with Hemedti in February of 2022, as Russia launched its invasion of Ukraine, Hemedti traveled to Moscow to give his backing to Russian plans to set up a Navy base on the Red Sea, a move Burhan refused to endorse. On that trip to Russia, the plane Hemedti traveled on was also transporting gold bullion, according to the New York Times, citing two senior Western officials. And during the talks in Moscow, Hemedti reportedly requested help from Russian officials to acquire military equipment. In 2021, as much as 32.7 tons of Sudanese gold, worth about $1.9 billion, was unaccompanied for, according to a report by U.S. broadcaster CNN. The report also found evidence that shows that Russia had worked closely with Sudan's military junta to ensure that billions of dollars in gold bypassed the Sudanese treasury in exchange for the Kremlin's political and military backing. All the while, this corrupt scheme involving the Wagner Group and the military government has been supervised by Hemedti, says Ahmed Abdullah, a Sudanese human rights campaigner in exile in Germany. It always felt like both men, Hemedti and Burhan, were never on the same page regarding how to do business with Wagner. Now, a new report suggests that Wagner has been supplying the RSF with missiles to support their fight against the Sudanese military. Last week, CNN reported that the open source group All Eyes on Wagner had analyzed satellite images that appeared to show a Russian transport plane shuttling between two key Libyan air bases controlled by Khalifa Haftar, a leader of the Eastern Libyan National Army, who is backed by the Wagner Group. Unbelievable. So the report alleged that an increase in activity by the Wagner Group at the air bases suggested there was a plan by both Russia and Haftar to back the RSF even before the conflict started. Behind Hemedti's push could be the Wagner Group, whose personnel was arrested and accused of gold smuggling by the Burhan regime just before the fighting began. Yasser Abdul Rahman, a Sudanese lawyer, advised Deutsche Welle, Hemedti and Wagner are like Siamese twins. But the Wagner Group's true intentions appear to remain unclear. Quote, while it appears that the Wagner Group has offered Hemedti military assistance, the Wagner Group's involvement and this conflict remains opaque. Isabella Curry, a researcher on the Wagner Group, advised Deutsche Welle. Caution is advised in drawing conclusions about a potential alliance between Wagner and Hamenti or Wagner's role in stoking civil unrest in Sudan. Instability in Sudan may not serve to benefit either the Putin regime or Prigozhin's network, particularly if the conflict begins to impact Sudan's border and the Central African Republic, where Prigozhin has established relationships and resource extraction contracts, she said. So that's the story. So that's the end of our day with you today. Tomorrow's another day, Friday. So we'll see what goes on tomorrow. And thanks for being with us. As always, a pleasure. 1 second. All right, I think we're good. So take care and be well. Goodbye.